4. The Benares put into Edge a little after noon on the next day. One of the mantas had died in harness, only 20 kilometers downriver from their destination, and A. Betic had cut it loose. The other had lasted until they tied up to the bleached pier, and then it rolled over in total exhaustion, bubbles rising from its twin air holes. Betic ordered this manta cut loose as well, explaining that it had a slim chance of surviving if it drifted along in the more rapid current. The pilgrims had been awake and watching the scenery roll by since before sunrise. They spoke little, and none had found anything to say to Martin Silenus. The poet did not appear to mind. He drank wine with his breakfast and sang bawdy songs as the sun rose. The river had widened during the night, and by morning it was a 2-kilometer-wide highway of blue-gray cutting through the low green hills south of the sea of grass. There were no trees this close to the sea, and the browns and golds and heather tones of the main shrubs had gradually brightened to the bold greens of the 2-meter-tall northern grasses. All morning the hills had been pressed lower, until now they were compressed into low bands of grassy bluffs on either side of the river. An almost invisible darkening hung above the horizon to the north and east. And those pilgrims who had lived on ocean worlds, and knew it as a promise of the approaching sea, had to remind themselves that the only sea now near was comprised of several billion acres of grass. Edge never had been a large outpost, and now it was totally deserted. The score of buildings lining the rutted lane from the dock had the vacant gaze of all abandoned structures, and there were signs on the riverfront that the population had fled weeks earlier. The Pilgrim's Rest, a 3-century-old inn just below the crest of the hill, had been burned. A. Betic accompanied them to the summit of a low bluff.
"What will you do now?"
Colonel Cassad asked the android.
"According to the terms of the Temple Bondature, we are free after this trip. We shall leave the Benares here for your return and take the launch downriver, and then we go on our way."
"With the general evacuations?"
asked Braun Lamia.
"No,"
Betic smiled.
"We have our own purposes and pilgrimages on Hyperion."
The group reached the rounded crest of the bluff. Behind them, the Benares seemed a small thing tied to a sagging dock. The Huli ran southwest into the blue haze of distance below the town and curved west above it, narrowing toward the impassable lower cataracts 12 kilometers upriver from Edge. To their north and east lay the sea of grass.
"My God,"
breathed Braun Lamia. It was as if they had climbed the last hill in creation. Below them, a scattering of docks, wharves, and sheds marked the end of Edge and the beginning of the sea. Grass stretched away forever, rippling sensuously in the slight breeze and seeming to lap like a green surf at the base of the bluffs. The grass seemed infinite and seamless, stretching to all horizons and apparently rising to precisely the same height as far as the eye could see. There was not the slightest hint of the snowy peaks of the Bridal Range, which they knew lay some 800 kilometers to the northeast. The illusion that they were gazing at a great green sea was nearly perfect, down to the wind-ruffled shimmers of stalks, looking like whitecaps far from shore.
"It's beautiful,"
said Lamia, who had never seen it before.
"It's striking at sunset and sunrise,"
said the consul.
"Fascinating,"
murmured Saul Weintraub, lifting his infant so that she could see. She wiggled in happiness and concentrated on watching her fingers.
"A well-preserved ecosystem,"
Hetmastine said approvingly.
"The Muir would be pleased."
"Shit,"
said Martin Silenus. The others turned to stare.
"There's no fucking wind wagon,"
said the poet. The four other men, woman, and android stared silently at the abandoned wharves and empty plain of grass.
It's been delayed, said the consul.
Martin Silenus barked a laugh.
Or it's left already. We were supposed to be here last night.
Colonel Cassad raised his powered binoculars and swept the horizon.
I find it unlikely that they would have left without us. The wagon was to have been sent by the Shrike Temple priests themselves. They have a vested interest in our pilgrimage.
We could walk, said Lenar Hoyt. The priest looked pale and weak, obviously in the grip of both pain and drugs, and barely able to stand, much less walk.
No. It's hundreds of clicks, and the grass is over our heads.
Compasses.
Compasses won't work on Hyperion,
said Cassad, still watching through his binoculars. Direction finders, then.
We have an IDF, but that isn't the point,
said the consul.
The grass is sharp. Half a click out, and we'd be nothing but tatters.
And there are the grass serpents,
said Cassad, lowering the glasses.
It's a well-preserved ecosystem, but not one to take a stroll in.
Father Hoyt sighed and half collapsed into the short grass of the hilltop. There was something close to relief in his voice when he said, All right, we go back. A. Betic stepped forward.
The crew will be happy to wait and ferry you back to Keats and the Benares, should the wind wagon not appear.
No. Take the launch and go.
Hey, just a fucking minute. I don't remember electing you, dictator amigo. We need to get there. If the fucking wind wagon doesn't show, we'll have to find another way.
The consul wheeled to face the smaller man.
How? By boat? It takes 2 weeks to sail up the main and around the north littoral to Otho or one of the other staging areas. And that's when there are ships available. Every seagoing vessel on Hyperion is probably evolved in the evacuation effort.
Dirigible, then,
growled the poet. Braun Lamia laughed.
Oh, yes. We've seen so many in the 2 days we've been on the river.
Martin Silenus whirled and clenched his fists, as if to strike the woman. Then he smiled.
All right, then, lady. What do we do? Maybe if we sacrifice someone to a grass serpent, the transportation gods will smile on us.
Braun Lamia's stare was arctic.
I thought burned offerings were more your style, little man.
Colonel Cassad stepped between the two. His voice barked command.
Enough! The consul's right. We stay here until the wagon arrives. M. Mistine, M. Lamia, go with A. Betic to supervise the unloading of our gear. Father Hoyt and M. Silenus will bring some wood up for a bonfire.
A bonfire? Said the priest. It was hot on the hillside.
After dark,
said Cassad.
We want the wind wagon to know we're here. Now let's move.
It was a quiet group that watched the powered launch move downriver at sunset. Even from 2 kilometers away, the consul could see the blue skins of the crew. The Benares looked old and abandoned at its wharf, already a part of the deserted city. When the launch was lost in the distance, the group turned to watch the sea of grass. Long shadows from the river bluffs crept out across what the consul already found himself thinking of as the surf and shallows. Farther out, the sea seemed to shift in color, the grass mellowing to an aquamarine shimmer before darkening to a hint of verdurous depths. The lapis sky melted into the reds and golds of sunset, illuminating their hilltop and setting the pilgrim skins aglow with liquid light. The only sound was the whisper of wind in grass.
We've got a fucking huge heap of baggage,
Martin Silenus said loudly.
For a bunch of folks on a one-way trip.
It was true, thought the consul. Their luggage made a small mountain on the grassy hilltop.
Somewhere in there,
came the quiet voice of Het Mastine,
may lie our salvation.
What do you mean?
Yeah,
said Martin Silenus, lying back, putting his hands under his head and staring at the sky.
Did you bring a pair of undershorts that are shrike-proof?
The Templar shook his head slowly. The sudden twilight cast his face in shadow under the cowl of the robe.
Let us not trivialize or dissemble. It is time to admit that each of us has brought on this pilgrimage something which he or she hopes will alter the inevitable outcome when the moment arrives that we must face the Lord of Pain.
The poet laughed.
I didn't even bring my lucky fucking rabbit's foot.
The Templar's hood moved slightly.
But your manuscript, perhaps?
The poet said nothing. Hetmastine moved his invisible gaze to the tall man on his left.
And you, Colonel, there are several trunks which bear your name. Weapons, perhaps?
Kassad raised his head but did not speak.
Of course. It would be foolish to go hunting without a weapon.
What about me?
Asked Braun Lamia, folding her arms.
Do you know what secret weapon I've smuggled along?
The Templar's oddly accented voice was calm.
We have not yet heard your tale, M. Lamia. It would be premature to speculate.
What about the consul?
Oh, yes. It is obvious what weapon our diplomatic friend has in store.
The consul turned from his contemplation of the sunset.
I brought only some clothes and 2 books to read,
he said truthfully.
Ah,
sighed the Templar.
But what a beautiful spacecraft you left behind.
Martin Silenus jumped to his feet.
The fucking ship! You can call it, can't you? Well, goddammit, get your dog whistle out. I'm tired of sitting here.
The consul pulled a strand of grass and stripped it. After a minute, he said,
Even if I could call it, and you heard Abetic say that the commsats and repeater stations were down, even if I could call it, we couldn't land north of the Bridal Range. That meant instant disaster even before the Shrike began ranging south of the mountains.
Yeah,
said Silenus, waving his arms in agitation.
But we could get across this fucking lawn. Call the ship!
Wait until morning. If the wind wagon's not here, we will discuss alternatives.
Fuck that,
began the poet. But Kassad stepped forward, with his back to him, effectively removing Silenus from the circle.
Emmestine, what is your secret?
There was enough light from the dying sky to show a slight smile on the Templar's thin lips. He gestured toward the mound of baggage.
As you see, my trunk is the heaviest and most mysterious of all.
It's a Mobius cube, said Father Hoyt. I've seen ancient artifacts transported that way.
Or fusion bombs,
said Kassad. Hetmastine shook his head.
Nothing so crude.
Are you going to tell us?
When it is my turn to speak.
Are you next?
Asked the consul.
We can listen while we wait.
Saul Weintraub cleared his throat.
I have number 4,
he said, showing the slip of paper.
But I would be more than pleased to trade with the true voice of the tree.
Weintraub lifted Rachel from his left shoulder to his right, patting her gently on the back. Hetmastine shook his head.
No, there is time. I meant only to point out that in hopelessness there is always hope. We have learned much from the story so far, yet each of us has some seed of promise buried even deeper than we have admitted.
I don't see, began Father Hoyt, but was interrupted by Martin Silenus's sudden shout.
It's the wagon! The fucking wind wagon! Here at last!
It was another 20 minutes before the wind wagon tied up to one of the wharves. The craft came out of the north, its sails white squares against a dark plain draining of color. The last light had faded by the time the large ship had tacked close to the low bluff, folded its mainsails, and rolled to a stop. The consul was impressed. The thing was wooden, handcrafted, and huge, curved in the pregnant lines of some sea-going galleon out of old Earth's ancient history. The single gigantic wheel, set in the center of the curving hull, normally would have been invisible in the 2-meter-tall grass. But the consul caught a glimpse of the underside as he carried luggage onto the wharf. From the ground it would be 6 or 7 meters to the railing, and more than 5 times that height to the tip of the mainmast. From where he stood, panting from exertion, the consul could hear the snap of pennants far above and a steady, almost subsonic hum that would be coming from either the ship's interior flywheel or its massive gyroscopes. A gangplank extruded from the upper hull and lowered itself to the wharf. Father Hoyt and Braun Lamia had to step back quickly or be crushed. The wind wagon was less well lighted than the Benares. Illumination appeared to consist of several lanterns hanging from spars. No crew had been visible during the approach of the ship, and no one came into view now.
"Hello!"
called the consul from the base of the gangplank. No one answered.
"Wait here a minute, please,"
said Kassad, and mounted the long ramp in 5 strides. The others watched while Kassad paused at the top, touched his belt where the small death wand was tucked, and then disappeared amidships. Several minutes later, a light flared through broad windows at the stern, casting trapezoids of yellow on the grass below.
"Come up,"
called Kassad from the head of the ramp.
"It's empty."
The group struggled with their luggage, making several trips. The consul helped Hetmastine with the heavy Mobius trunk, and through his fingertips he could feel a faint but intense vibration.
"So where the fuck is the crew?"
asked Martin Silenus when they were assembled on the foredeck. They had taken their single-file tour through the narrow corridors and cabins, down stairways more ladder than stairs, and through cabins not much bigger than the built-in bunks they contained. Only the rearmost cabin, the captain's cabin, if that is what it was, approached the size and comfort of standard accommodations on the Benares.
"It's obviously automated,"
said Kassad. The force officer pointed to halyards which disappeared into slots in the deck, manipulators all but invisible among the rigging and spars, and the subtle hint of gears halfway up the lateen-rigged rear mast.
"I didn't see a control center, not so much as a disky or C-spot nexus."
She slipped her comm log from a breast pocket and tried to interface on standard data, comm, and biomed frequencies. There was no response from the ship.
"The ships used to be crewed,"
said the consul.
"Temple initiates used to accompany the pilgrims to the mountains."
"Well, they're not here now," said Hoyt. "But I guess we can assume that someone is still alive at the tram station or Keep Kronos. They sent the wagon for us."
"Or everyone's dead and the wind wagon is running on an automatic schedule."
She looked over her shoulder as rigging and canvas creaked in a sudden gust of wind.
"Damn, it's weird to be cut off from everybody and everything like this. It's like being blind and deaf. I don't know how colonials stand it."
Martin Silenus approached the group and sat on the railing. He drank from a long green bottle and said,
"Where's the poet? Show him. Show him, muses mine, that I may know him. 'Tis the man who with a man is an equal, be he king or poorest of the beggar class, or any other wondrous thing a man may be twixt ape and Plato. 'Tis the man who with a bird, wren, or eagle finds his way to all its instincts. He hath heard the lion's roaring, and can tell what his horny throat expresseth. And to him the tiger's yell comes articulate, and presseth on his ear like mother tongue."
"Where did you get that wine bottle?"
asked Kassad. Martin Silenus smiled. His eyes were small and bright in the lantern glow.
"The galley's fully stocked. And there's a bar. I declare it open."
"We should fix some dinner,"
said the consul, although all he wanted at the moment was some wine. It had been more than 10 hours since they had last eaten. There came a clank and whir, and all 6 of them moved to the starboard rail. The gangplank had drawn itself in. They whirled again as canvas unfurled, lines grew taut, and somewhere a flywheel hummed into the ultrasonic. Sails filled, the deck tilted slightly, and the wind wagon moved away from the wharf and into the darkness. The only sounds were the flap and creak of the ship, the distant rumble of the wheel, and the rasp of grass on the hull bottom. The six of them watched as the shadow of the bluff fell behind, the unlighted beacon pyre receding as a faint gleam of starlight on pale wood. And then there were only the sky and night and swaying circles of lantern light.
"I'll go below," said the consul,
"and see if I can get a meal together."
The others stayed above a while, feeling the slight surge and rumble through the soles of their feet and watching darkness pass. The sea of grass was visible only as the place where stars ended and flat blackness began. Cassad used a hand beam to illuminate glimpses of canvas and rigging, lines being pulled tight by invisible hands, and then he checked all the corners and shadowed places from stern to bow. The others watched in silence. When he clicked the light off, the darkness seemed less oppressive, the starlight brighter. A rich, fertile smell, more of a farm in springtime than of the sea, came to them on a breeze which had swept across 1,000 kilometers of grass. Some time later, the consul called to them and they went below to eat. The galley was cramped and there was no mess table, so they used the large cabin in the stern as their common room, pushing three of the trunks together as a makeshift table. Four lanterns swinging from low beams made the room bright. A breeze blew in when Hetmastin opened one of the tall windows above the bed. The consul set plates piled high with sandwiches on the largest trunk and returned again with thick white cups and a coffee therm. He poured while the others ate.
"This is quite good," said Fedman Kassad. "Where did you get the roast beef?"
"The cold box is fully stocked. There's another large freezer in the aft pantry."
"Electrical?" asked Hetmastin.
"No, double insulated."
Martin Silenus sniffed a jar, found a knife on the sandwich plate, and added great dollops of horseradish to his sandwich. His eyes sparkled with tears as he ate.
"How long does this crossing generally take?"
Lamia asked the consul. He looked up from his study of the circle of hot black coffee in his cup.
"I'm sorry, what?"
"Crossing the Sea of Grass? How long?"
"A night and a half a day to the mountains, if the winds are with us."
"And then? How long to cross the mountains?" asked Father Hoyt.
"Less than a day."
"If the tramway is running,"
added Kassad. The consul sipped the hot coffee and made a face.
"We have to assume it is. Otherwise..."
"Otherwise what?"
"Otherwise,"
said Colonel Kassad, moving to the open window and putting his hands on his hips,
"we'll be stranded 600 clicks from the time tombs and 1,000 from the southern cities."
The consul shook his head.
"No. The temple priests, or whoever are behind this pilgrimage, have seen to it that we've gotten this far. They'll make sure we go all the way."
Braun Lamia crossed her arms and frowned.
"As what? Sacrifices?"
Martin Silenus whooped a laugh and brought out his bottle.
"Who are these coming to the sacrifice? To what green altar, O mysterious priest, leadst thou that heifer, lowing at the skies and all her silken flanks with garlands dressed? What little town by river or seashore or mountain built with peaceful citadel is emptied of its folk this pious morn? And, little town, thy streets for evermore will silent be, and not a soul to tell why thou art desolate can e'er return."
Braun Lamia reached under her tunic and brought out a cutting laser no larger than her little finger. She aimed it at the poet's head.
"You miserable little shit! One more word out of you, and I swear I'll slag you where you stand!"
The silence was suddenly absolute, except for the background rumble groan of the ship. The consul moved toward Martin Silenus. Colonel Cassad took two steps behind Lamia. The poet took a long drink and smiled at the dark-haired woman. His lips were moist.
Oh, build your ship of death. Oh, build it.
Lamia's fingers were white on the pencil laser. The consul edged closer to Silenus, not knowing what to do, imagining the whipping beam of light fusing his own eyes. Cassad leaned toward Lamia like 2 meters of tense shadow.
Madam,
said Saul Weintraub from where he sat on the bunk against the far wall.
Need I remind you that there is a child present?
Lamia glanced to her right. Weintraub had removed a deep drawer from a ship's cupboard and had set it on the bed as a cradle. He had bathed the infant and come in silently just before the poet's recitation. Now he set the baby softly in the padded nest.
I'm sorry,
said Braun Lamia and lowered the small laser.
It's just that he makes me so angry.
Weintraub nodded, rocking the drawer slightly. The gentle roll of the wind wagon, combined with the incessant rumble of the great wheel, appeared to have already put the child to sleep.
We're all tired and tense. Perhaps we should find our lodgings for the night and turn in.
The woman sighed and tucked the weapon in her belt.
I won't sleep. Things are too strange.
Others nodded. Martin Silenus was sitting on the broad ledge below the stern windows. Now he pulled up his legs, took a drink, and said to Weintraub,
Tell your story, old man.
Yes, said Father Hoyt. The priest looked exhausted to the point of being cadaverous, but his feverish eyes burned. Tell us. We need to have the stories told and time to think about them before we arrive. Weintraub passed a hand across his bald scalp.
It's a dull tale. I've never been to Hyperion before. There are no confrontations with monsters, no acts of heroism. It's a tale by a man whose idea of epic adventure is speaking to a class without his notes.
All the better,
said Martin Silenus.
We need a soporific.
Saul Weintraub sighed, adjusted his glasses, and nodded. There were a few streaks of dark in his beard, but most of it had gone gray. He turned the lantern low over the baby's bed and moved to a chair in the center of the room. The consul turned down the other lamps and poured more coffee for those who wanted it. Saul Weintraub's voice was slow, careful in phrase and precise in wording. And before long, the gentle cadence of his story blended with the soft rumble and slow pitchings of the wind wagon's progress north.